This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
Sometimes Wall Street makes sense, sometimes it doesn't. Which one do you think today is, huh? We'll tell you about the fourth biggest burger chain in the country. Yes, the fourth biggest. And a field trip to the future of the American shopping mall. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Thursday, today the 17th of April. Glad as always to have you with us. There are days when the curiosities, shall we say, of the American economy, of Wall Street in particular, are on full display. Today, as you might have guessed, is one of them. This morning, Goldman Sachs told the world that its profits fell 11% last quarter, somewhere on the order of $300 million. Not, in other words, chump change. And yet, its shares were up in trading today. It happens all the time, this kind of thing does, where bad news in the markets is good or good news is apparently bad. Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports now from New York on why and how that happens.
It's actually pretty simple, just an expectations game. Amy Hutton is a professor at Boston College's business school.
When Goldman announces their earnings, even if they're down from last quarter or last year, if they're higher than the expectation built into the stock price is going to go up.
Bad news can be perversely good, as long as Wall Street expect it worse. So it's important for companies to fine-tune those investor expectations. It's a lot like a kid who blows a test. It's better to tell the parents before the report card comes. If your parents are both accounting professors, they call that giving guidance.
If my daughter has a test that's particularly difficult, we hear about it beforehand.
James Myers and his wife Linda study these investment issues at University of Arkansas. They say their kids make good grades and rarely need to, but sometimes a warning is wise.
Because our expectations are a little bit lower, then we wouldn't be as concerned about the low grade. And I think it's a pretty good analogy of what managers might do.
University of Michigan accounting professor Greg Miller says company guidance can work the same way. Just like parents, investors don't like surprises.
If you surprise people, they get madder. And so if there's something coming that people are going to be unhappy about, I'd rather own up to it now and let them know, because they're going to be mad at me either way about the bad news.
Companies try to manage Wall Street's expectations to make sure a bad earnings report doesn't torpedo the stock price. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Came across a story in the New York Times today about forced arbitration, how companies are changing their terms of service so that almost any interaction from social media to downloading a coupon might limit your right to sue. We sent Marketplace's David Gura off today to find out how widespread this practice might actually be.
Arbitration clauses are buried in those terms of service agreements you almost certainly skim. Brian Fitzpatrick's a law professor at Vanderbilt, and he says companies probably don't mind that you click yes without reading the fine print.
They don't want you reading the terms of these contracts simply because it would take so long, no one would buy anything.
But we enter into contracts with companies in less direct ways. Some argue this takes place when you buy their products, or when you use one of their coupons, or when you walk into a restaurant. The fine print has gotten smaller, and it's gotten buried, he says, on the bottom of a French fry container or inside a package.
You have to admit that when it comes to consumer contracts, consent is a fiction.
Imri Salahi teaches law at Loyola University. Salahi says forced arbitrations become popular in consumer transactions, in the workplace, and in hospitals.
When my first child was born, I was asked to sign an arbitration clause at the delivery room.
Salahi says he had his wife sign the form, his thinking being, she'd just gone through labor. What judge would say she had a clear state of mind at the time? Jay Tidmarsh is a law professor at Notre Dame, and he says companies like arbitration because it takes less time and it's less expensive.
The use of class actions in consumer cases was a real motivation for businesses to try to figure out ways to take these cases back out of litigation.
Arbitration also tends to go faster. It's not as public, and there are no juries. Tidmarsh says we could see more challenges to rules like these, but in recent years, in arbitration cases, the Supreme Court has sided with companies. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
A quick ACA update now before we get to that thing we always do after the top of the news. President Obama took to the podium today in the White House briefing room. There were questions from the assembled crowd about Ukraine and immigration, but the president was there to talk health care. So here's the takeaway for you. Enrollment is now at 8 million. That's up a bit from a week or two ago. And he also said that 35% of the signups are people under the age of 35, arguably a healthier slice of the population, which is good for insurance companies. All right, on Wall Street today, it was a little bit bumpy. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Millennials, that is the generation born between roughly the early 1980s and the early 2000s, well, they're growing up, which means they've got more money, which means marketers are starting to pay more attention to them. But every generation is different. So what do marketers really know about selling big-ticket items to millennials? Gen X reporter Sally Herships has that story.
It's a weekday evening in Beverly Hills, and the Gagosian Gallery is hosting a rooftop reception. Price tags on the artwork here go up to several million dollars. Maybe you're imagining an older crowd. If so, you'd be wrong. These art lovers are young.
Well, we don't want to get stale.
Deborah McLeod is the gallery's director. She says it wants to reach a young demographic, specifically millennials. Thus, this special event for a young group.
They come into the gallery in tennis shoes, but they've made, you know, a mountain of money. So they're the idea generation, you know, we want them in the gallery.
The millennial generation is enormous, 97 million in the U.S. Marketers are still figuring out how to reach this age group. Across the country, in Midtown New York, Pam Danziger, a luxury marketing consultant, is giving a talk to an audience of jewelers from the gold industry.
You believe that the millennials are going to respond the same way that all other generations have done. If you think that the same answers, the same solutions, the same branding propositions are going to work for them, you're sadly mistaken.
Danziger says the group does not want its grandparents' luxury products.
When we're talking about marketing jewelry, I think we have to start thinking about, well, what kind of jewelry goes with a yoga pant? And even more importantly for this generation, what kind of jewelry goes with tattoos?
To find out what millennials really want, I headed a few blocks south to the studio of jewelry designer Pamela Love. Love is 32, and she and all 18 of her employees, except one, are millennials. So what do millennials actually want to see?
I don't think millennials want to see anything. I think we want to discover it on our own, and I think we really want to be treated with the respect of being given the information that we want without being sort of pandered to.
That sounds like incredibly difficult to deal with as a marketer. How do you cope with that? Like, what do you do?
Financially, it's very easy to deal with that as a marketer.
Love says as a marketer, less accomplishes more. She hates being bombarded with emails from a brand, so her company has a light touch. Her new campaign for Barney's hangs posters on the sides of buildings and construction sites so consumers can discover them on their own, which she says is a lot cheaper than taking out an ad in a magazine. There's just one catch.
It's illegal, but the only thing that really happens is the guy putting them up could potentially get arrested.
Has that happened?
Not to us, no.
Love's newest poster is an illustration of a woman standing in front of a map which has jewelry pinned to it. She says she hopes the poster tells a story. Mary Lee Bliss is with Y-Pulse, a youth marketing and research firm. She says for millennials, story is key.
Making it more than just a product. You know, it gives it a background that you can connect with emotionally rather than it just being a thing.
She played me an ad on YouTube with 15 million hits. It's a story about a poor boy who steals medicine for his sick mom.
God, I'm such a sucker. I'm like crying.
I know. It's a tearjerker. We call it tissue box marketing because it really is about evoking that reaction. And it's so intense. But, you know, as you watch it, you don't see a brand.
Bliss says millennials like to share experiences. They don't like to show off. So her advice to marketers, stop trying to promote your brand and instead focus on emotion. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
All right, I'm going to throw out a corporate slogan here and see whether you can tell me what business it's associated with. All right, here you go. Service with the speed of sound. Anybody? Nobody? All right, the answer is Sonic, the fast food burger joint. Chances are, though, that some of you, most of you probably, have never been to a Sonic because the vast majority of their restaurants are down in the southern part of the United States. Be that as it may, though, Sonic is the fourth largest burger chain in this country, and it is looking to expand big time. Marketplace's David Weinberg has that story.
There are about 3,500 Sonics around the country, mostly located in Texas, Oklahoma, Tennessee, and Mississippi. But the company plans on opening 1,000 additional locations over the next decade.
With this move, we see Sonic entering that arena of the largest national players and kind of leaving behind those regional players.
Patrick Lanau is a spokesperson for Sonic, which is known for reviving the classic American drive-in. Food is ordered through an intercom and delivered to your car, often by servers on roller skates.
The main difference that sets drive-ins and drive-thrus apart is that the demand for drive-ins are more heavily dependent on the weather.
Hester Jen, an analyst with Ibis World, says that Sonic's business dips pretty dramatically during the colder months. That may explain why it's focusing much of its expansion into California.
When I think of one of the most successful burger chains in the U.S., I think of In-N-Out Burger, which originated in California as a drive-in.
Darren Tristano is a food service concept and menu expert with Technomic. He says Sonic's strategy has been to differentiate itself from its competitors by emphasizing its non-burger menu items, like the more than 1 million different soda flavors it offers.
They also sell hot dogs that are very regionalized in terms of flavor and have items like tater tots on the menu.
So if you don't live in the South and you get a late-night craving for chocolate, pineapple soda, and tater tots delivered on roller skates, soon you may be able to satisfy it. I'm David Weinberg from Marketplace.
Coming up, the shopping mall reconsidered.
The most productive retailers and restaurateurs are all on streets anywhere in the world.
But first, let's do the numbers. Stocks were mixed today. The Dow Industrials traded lower, dropped about 16 points. The blue chips did a tenth of 1%, 16,408. The NASDAQ nudged up 9 points, a quarter of 1%, ended things at 4,095. The S&P 500 ticked up 2.5 points. That's a tenth percent, 1864. Expectations, as we said up top, was the word of the day. IBM missed them, traded down 3%. Morgan Stanley surprised Wall Street, traded up almost 3%. Other companies that surpassed expectations included Goldman Sachs, which inched up a tenth of 1%. Today, PepsiCo bubbled up 0.9%. AutoNation parked a 2% gain today as well. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.72%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events for Friday. It's Good Friday. The stock market will be closed, but most banks and businesses will be open. Happy birthday to Melissa Joan Hart. Sabrina, America's favorite teenage witch, turns 38. And pop quiz. On April 18, 1775, this man earned his place in American history for his famous ride alerting everyone that some unwanted guests were on their way. I'm Millie Jefferson.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. If you work for an American corporation, you may have heard of BYOD, Bring Your Own Device. It started when offers workers ditched the company BlackBerry and shelled out their own money to buy an iPhone for work. That helped bring mobile computing devices into the workplace. And now the same thing is happening with workplace software. Workers are ditching generic Microsoft products and using all sorts of alternatives. And that has Silicon Valley interested, as Marketplace's Quina Kim reports.
In the not-so-distant past, if you wanted software for work, say like PowerPoint or Photoshop,
you used to have to go to your IT guy to get a licensed version on your computer.
Tom Eich heads up the digital tools practice at IDEO, a design consulting firm. He says there's a trend that's reshaping the workplace.
Yeah, bring your own software, the consumerization of IT. And now you can just go online and find most everything.
And most of it's for free. Office workers are turning to Dropbox instead of FTPing files to the company server. They're ditching Word and using Google Docs when they need to share. And they're doing it without the IT department's permission. Eich says it's this shift in buying power that's whetting investors' appetites in productivity software or tools that make you work better.
A lot of the interesting innovations are actually entering through the consumer channels first.
Startups are more focused on workers' needs. Among them, getting rid of email.
People are complaining about how much email is dominating their work lives. So there's a need there that definitely will push companies to find better solutions.
I went to check out one of these startups. It's called Asana.
Hi, my name is Dustin Moskovitz, and I'm one of the co-founders of Asana.
Moskovitz is a founder of Facebook, which has the unofficial motto, move fast and break things. And in the early days, it was Moskovitz's job to keep Facebook moving fast.
I would spend a lot of my day just trying to figure out what was going on. And that's when we got into the pattern that most companies still use today, which is just sending around a lot of email threads. And being my first job, I figured there was probably great tooling out there to help me. I was really shocked to find that there was nothing really that helped with coordinating all of the work you were doing day to day.
And so Moskovitz started writing the software himself. He says engineers at Google, Apple, and other tech companies have done the same thing. And those management tools have cut down on email and workers are more productive. Moskovitz thinks these tools are part of Silicon Valley's success, and he wants to sell them to businesses around the world. And in the Valley, it sort of feels like everybody's using Asana, including startups like Uber, Airbnb, Nest, and Pinterest, which is where I am right now.
We are on the upper floor of the office right now, which is predominantly engineering.
That's Tim Kendall. He heads up products at Pinterest, and we're in a huge loft-like building in San Francisco. Kendall says when he joined Pinterest last year, there were 18 employees. Today, there are about 250.
A lot of our projects require product design, they require engineering, they require marketing, and tools like Asana can allow you to track all those different components.
Kendall flips open his MacBook Air and shows me how Asana works.
So this is my dashboard.
It's not quite the brave new world I was expecting. It sort of looks like a mashup of software like GDocs and a to-do list. And Kendall was using email.
I still use email, but I'm able to track a higher volume of projects and workflows without commensurately increasing the volume of email.
I see lots of challenges.
That's Tom Eich from IDEO again. Eich says it's early days and there aren't any clear-cut winners or losers yet. But he says there's no turning back.
Once you've had a workforce that's completely grown up immersed in digital technology, they're not going to accept a toolkit from their employer that's so much worse than the thing that they experience in their personal lives.
You know who he's talking about. The youth. In San Francisco, I'm Quina Kim for Marketplace.
Consider, for just a minute, the classic American shopping mall. A couple of big box retailers, a food court, and some smaller one-off shops. Also, possibly doomed. The Great Recession and its aftermath have not been kind to the standard enclosed indoor mall. A lot of people, in fact, have been saying the outright death of that particular shopping experience is only a matter of time, and that the future of the mall might look and sound a lot like this.
Good afternoon, folks. Welcome aboard the 1717 trolley here at Americana and Brand.
Yes, a trolley in a shopping mall. Michael Bublé playing on the speakers.
At least for once.
A computer-controlled water fountain that could honestly be in Las Vegas. Tiffany's and Barnes & Noble, the Apple Store, and a bunch of restaurants laid out along fake but quite picturesque streets. Apartments and condos upstairs, all of it open to the outside Southern California air, and all of it the brainchild of a guy who, yes, does have a stake in the death of the old-fashioned mall, but who's also put his money where his mouth is. So today on Conversations from the Corner Office, or actually, that shopping mall, Rick Caruso. He's the founder and CEO of Caruso Affiliated, one of the biggest privately held real estate development companies in the country. He owns, in addition to the Americana, where we are, a couple more just like it all over Southern California. And when we met up the other day, I started with that basic question, why he thinks old-style malls are going to disappear.
Well, look at this place. So we're here in later in the afternoon, and it's packed with people, right?
Yep.
And it's people shopping, it's people eating, it's people just hanging out with their family and friends. There's people just walking through the park because it taps into the natural rhythm of how we all live. Nobody naturally wants to go inside an enclosed box and spend the afternoon.
I totally grant you that, but we're in L.A. on a lovely afternoon. This doesn't work in a dine in Minnesota.
Well, I disagree with that.
Really?
The most productive retailers and restaurateurs are all on streets anywhere in the world. So there isn't a mall in New York City that does better than Fifth Avenue or Madison Avenue. There isn't a mall in Chicago that does better than Michigan Avenue.
So that's
there isn't a mall in Italy that does better than Via Veneto.
That's the through line. Fifth Avenue is a mall, in essence.
Yeah, but people want to be outdoors. And even in the bad weather, they'll be outdoors. Now, are there times where indoor malls are more convenient? I think so.
He says with air quotes.
but an indoor mall has now become a destination. Somebody goes there, shops what they want, and then they leave.
And right? fights through the parking lot and
right.
all of that.
And it's not a great experience. And the other thing is, which I really strongly believe in, all of us today are so pressured with time. None of us have time. So when we do have time to do something, we want to capture a better experience out of it, right? My goal is to get all of our guests here to stay a long time.
Guests. Interesting phrase.
Yeah, they're our guests. They're not our customers. My customer.
Well, if they're not your customers, you're not going to be in business too long, right?
Well, so let me tell you who my customer is. My customer is Barnes & Noble, Nordstrom, Calvin Klein. That's my customer.
Huh.
Their customer is my guest. And so if every day we create a great guest experience, then people return over and over and over again.
I'll tell you what. So a week or two ago, I had to go to the Apple store right across this two-acre okay. park that's in the middle yeah. here. I brought three of my kids with me. We were in and out of the Apple store in 15 minutes.
Okay.
Wound up staying an hour and a half.
There you go.
Sitting on the
that.
Lawn. Now, we didn't spend another dime, I got
to
tell you.
You don't
but
have
we just
to.
Sat around.
You don't have to.
It was
to.
Interesting.
But what I would ask you is, the next time you have to go somewhere to pick up something, is your choice going to be here? Because you do get to spend that hour and a half with your three kids was precious, right?
Yeah. Mostly, but you know.
Mostly, right.
You know.
But you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So we've created an environment where you can just come and enjoy yourself. And I'm going to get you the next time. Right?
Not now, you're not.
So I'm not worried about, you know, what will happen is with frequency, you will yeah. shop here more often.
Yeah.
But now it's where people walk their dogs, and they're out with their kids, and they're hanging out. It's an extension of their backyard.
Where's the growth then for you? Are you going to be in New York and Washington, D.C.? I mean, you can see this playing out in Tyson's Corner. You can see it playing,
yeah.
you know.
I think we got a lot of opportunities. I'm a real believer, though, for what we do. I think we need to focus pretty local. I think we're going to stick to California because when you're building these things, there's so much level of detail, not only in designing it and building it, but then operating it. Because every day it has to be perfect. Every day it's showtime. We're in the entertainment business. You step on this property 8 in the morning, it's got to be perfect.
Hmm.
To replicate that for a long distance away from your home becomes much more difficult. So I would rather be the best at what we do, not worry about being the biggest at what we do.
I say this not pejoratively at all. I say it with admiration for what that company has managed to do. It seems almost Disney-like, this place. You step into Disneyland at 8 in the morning, and everybody's in costume, and the characters are out.
Right. There's a little bit of that. There's yeah. no doubt. And we study Disney, and Disney studies us. And we spend a lot of time with the Disney folks.
Huh.
Because Disney is very good at what they do, and we're very good at what we do. And we share a lot of techniques of how to create a memorable experience.
What's it going to look like? The death of the American mall? Not the growth of this place, but the
yeah.
death of the mall.
Well,
because it's dislocation, right? It's people losing jobs. It's companies going out of business. It's
Yeah, but I think it's going to evolve. I think what's going to happen is that the malls are going to try to figure out, and will figure out, how to reinvent themselves. The B-level and C-level malls, I think, have a very bleak future. I think those properties are going to be reused. I think the A malls are going to figure out how to scale down, curate themselves better. They've got some huge challenges with Sears and a JCPenney.
Yeah, right?
Those boxes close. You can't fill those spaces. Right. So you're going to tear those things down. But maybe they become hotels or housing or something else. They're going to have to evolve. They're just going to have to.
Rick Caruso, thanks very much.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out today from the cutting room floor, if you will, of that Rick Caruso interview. Here you go.
What's your very favorite part of this place? I know it's like picking your kids, but...
Well, my very favorite part of this place would be my kids. There's statues of my kids in the park.
No, come on. Really? All right, you can't pick that one. Pick a different one.
Okay, you have statues. How about the bus of my kids up on that building over there?
No, you can't do your kids. Something else.
How about the trolley with a number on it that's secret?
All right, well, now I have to go look.
The number is 1717. What does that number mean?
I don't know, but Marketplace listeners are a smart bunch. They'll figure it out.
The number of the trolley at the Grove is 1759.
It's got to be some old, like, red line L.A. streetcar thing.
You got to figure it out. You figure it out, you get a free Sprinkles cupcake.
You're on. All right, here are the rules, 1717 and 1759. You tweet us your answer, at Marketplace APM is us. We'll take all the correct responses we get, put them in a hopper, randomly pick the winner. Remember, a Sprinkles cupcake is on the line. Also, employees of American Public Media and its affiliates are not eligible. All right, we're done. I had to do that because somebody here apparently knows the answer to that one. All right, that's it. We're really done this time. That is Marketplace from APM on this Thursday. John Buckley, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, George Judson, Ethan Lindsay, Margarita Noriega, Dave Shaw and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Sarah Gilbert. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.